This is episode one of the Software Freedom Law Show.
Welcome to the Software Freedom Law Show. I'm Bradley Kuhn.
And I'm Karen Sandler. And welcome to our first episode.
This is our second episode, which happens to be episode one, because the first episode was episode zero. We discussed this on the last podcast, the difference between ordinal and...
But episode one sounds like our podcast is part of Star Wars.
Well, look, that's just not fair. Okay, so just because you use the phrase episode one is not a reference to Star Wars. And I want to be clear that I do not want to...
And episode one was so bad.
Exactly. My point is that I don't want this podcast referring at all to Star Wars, because Star Wars is a universe filled with all sorts of problems. It is effectively a kid's movie. It is not really a good science fiction story. And this is why I am wholeheartedly a Star Trek fan.
I was going to say, here's where our listeners find out that we both are Star Trek fans.
Yes, I guess that's true. So you're in agreement with me on Star Wars. So saying episode one will not be considered a Star Wars reference, and we will continue to be Star Trek
fans. Well, I appreciate Star Wars for what it is, but it is no Star Trek.
Yeah, it's a strange thing that the two of us are here reviewing Star Wars and Star Trek and relative benefits of the two, benefits like clear and contrast of the two or whatever. You know, I guess it's good to see that a software developer / engineer and a lawyer can have this in common to actually have the conversation about Star Trek.
Well, to get on with it, neither of us are just a developer engineer or just a lawyer.
Well, that's definitely true, but I mean, there's somewhat of a chasm between the two to some extent. I think the engineers struggle with understanding legal concepts, and lawyers, I think, sometimes struggle with understanding developers and engineers and how their minds work.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I was just saying that, you know, you are a developer, but you've been active in the legal community mm-hmm. for a long time.
Oh, at least in the free software legal area. That's a very small little cubbyhole of the legal
that's
world.
That's true, but you spend a very large percentage of your time working on legal matters.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and I'm a lawyer, but I was an engineer first.
That's right. You have an undergraduate degree in engineering, and mm-hmm. you've done high-order calculus and all that cool stuff as an undergrad. But then you decided to go to law school, as we were talking about our last podcast. So what was that culture shock like from going from being an engineer to a lawyer?
It was a big culture shock, but I was actually really, really worried uh-huh. Because I thought I would be outclassed by all those liberal arts majors when we started law school.
Did you know any liberal arts majors?
I didn't know a single liberal arts major, which is the problem.
English majors when I was in college did no work at all and just sort of breezed through, in my feeling. But,
Cooper Union
anyway.
Doesn't have any liberal arts majors.
I see.
So I was really apprehensive. Yeah. But it turned out that when I got there, I found out that that actually engineering school had prepared me really well for law school.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in part because one of the strange things was that I found that just having gone to engineering school made me a much better writer. And part of that was the whole getting very comfortable with logic and analysis in that way.
Oh, that's interesting, because most people say that the stereotype of the engineer is a bad writer, somebody who can't write down ideas and express them. So it's interesting that actually the writing that you did as an engineering student helped you.
Absolutely, because legal analysis is very logic-based.
Ah.
Yeah, so actually legal writing, I think engineers tend to be quite good at.
Hmm.
I mean, it sort of depends. But that whole kind of logical thought was really, and analytic tools really helped me in law school. For example, I found that it was really easy for me to understand contract drafting right away.
Why was that?
I know it sounds really counterintuitive, but it's because there are all these defined terms in contract language, and that's what trips up a lot of lawyers, because you've got all these really intricately involved defined terms. One that refers to the other that are very precisely drafted, and they recur in the text. But because I had done a lot of programming, defined terms was really easy for me. So it was a really funny situation where I realized that actually that experience really helped me as a lawyer, and as a corporate lawyer in particular.
So lawyers are actually challenged by that concept at first, at least, when they're first introduced to it in their first year of law school. That's interesting. Yeah, and of course, when I first looked at, you know, various different legal documents, contracts, and licenses, you know, the issue of defined terms was never even something I thought in that much detail about, because I saw it as just a variable, right? I mean, you're assigning a variable a value, and that value stays the same. I mean, it's not even a variable in the sense of it changes. It's it's basically constants that you pound define through the very beginning of the contract or license, and those pound defines get expanded as you go through. I mean, they're basically little macros as you go through, and I always saw them that way.
Yeah, it felt very natural to me too, because I was coming from that background. But I think for lawyers coming from that liberal arts background that we were referring to before, that's very new to them, and it's not something they encounter before.
Yeah, but of course, I think the challenge for the developer looking at them as macros or pound defines, as things that are expanded quite literally throughout the text, developers tend to have this very literal reading, because that's, of course, what a compiler or an interpreter is going to do. It's going to interpret the things very, very literally, exactly what you said. Mm-hmm. And it's not always the case that a legal document works that way, where things are absolutely literal and so forth.
Right. Well, I guess part of it is that there are judgment calls built into contracts and built into defined terms. But also, those terms can get reinterpreted, maybe by a court or just because of the particular facts at play that may not have been anticipated. It's not necessarily a straight correlation.
Right, and I guess it's also the case that there's a context of judgment around a contract or a license, and the judgments change because court decisions change and the way things are looked at change over time. So you really have to take the environment and apply it to the thing you're reading.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very strange for development. I think system integrators, people who do lots of large systems with lots of components, probably are easier with that than the developer, because they think in terms of their program and the space that it's in, and don't think as much about the larger picture.
So how did you feel? Because I mean, you started out at the FSF, where licensing is such an important part of what the FSF does, and I know that from our last episode you were saying that it was actually reading the GPL and the manifesto that got you involved. So how did you feel as a developer?
Obviously, when I first read the GPL, I read it quite literally, and in particular the issue of derivative works and whether something is or is not a derivative work under copyright law, which is sort of the centerpiece of copyleft. Is when something's a derivative work, then the copyleft requirements kick in. And I looked at that quite in a literal fashion and said, well, there is an answer. Like, everything either is or is not a derivative work, and you do some sort of program. And in fact, many people make this mistake if they think of the GPL or copyright law as a program that you run and you get its output, you know, and you say, okay, run copyright law against this set of facts and you will get an answer. And I think that kind of thinking is where developers and engineers get dangerous when they try to think about law, because they don't understand that it's a little more fuzzy than that.
It's funny, because that kind of thinking is actually very helpful for a lawyer, for a young lawyer. And it's actually one of the ways that I described to junior attorneys when I was at a law firm, and we had a lot of attorneys coming straight out of law school, and they had to figure out how to interpret contracts. But I see it having the opposite effect.
Right. Well, quite literally, developers take it to its logical conclusion and determine that there is some sort of output you can get and an answer you can always get. And I think one of the challenges is looking at the way that lawyers tend to analyze things. They look at facts and apply the law as it currently stands, and then figure out what the likelihood is a court going to say this or that.
And also identifying which aspects of the language are judgments.
Right, yeah, because if you look at a statute, you have to sort of consider the legislative history and consider how courts have looked at it in the past. Mm-hmm. And the courts have, of course, applied that judgment to the statute, and that judgment that has been applied and how it's likely to be applied really influences various decisions you make about, for example, whether something is or is not a derivative work.
That's right. And actually, even within a court case itself, in a decision, there's a lot of discussion in any given decision that isn't actually the decision, but is the rationale of how the judges came to that decision. And that's, it's called dicta, but it's not, it's a judgment call as to how much of that actually applies to the next situation.
So one of the things we might want to do is let's find one piece of advice that we want an engineer or a developer to hear about the law and what we would want a lawyer to hear about engineering and development. I think what I would say to the engineer trying to understand the law, and you can tell me if this is right, is don't be so literal. Think in terms of how it operates in the larger context of the courts and so forth. And don't assume that every legal question has a little literal answer in the way that a computer problem or a technological problem usually does. You think that's probably good advice to the engineer?
I think that's a good advice.
And so what would our advice be to the lawyer?
Wonder if it would be something like, you know, something like what I was saying that I talked to young lawyers about, which is, you know, apply structure to your legal thought. You know, really examine what those defined terms are and apply them consistently. That consistency actually is probably the
best. I mean, that's one thing developers are very good at is consistency and they're thinking about how situations occur. And I think probably lawyers could learn that from developers because developers have to approach each technological problem in terms of let's consistently do a scientific-like method on it to figure out what the answer is, and lawyers should certainly apply the same, and that's where they can help each other. So our hope is that developers and lawyers will learn from each other because both have amazing skills that can help the other's profession and work.
And in the next segment, we also have a developer and a lawyer.
Yes, an engineer and a lawyer.
In one person.
In one person. And our next segment will introduce you to him, and it's going to be our exciting first interview. So stay tuned for the next segment. Well, Karen, we've got an excellent guest for our first guest on our podcast. We have Scott Peterson, who is a lawyer at HP and has been involved with free software licensing for a while, isn't it?
It's really exciting. Hi, Scott.
Hi, it's great to be with both of you.
Yeah, we thought it would really be a great choice to have you as our first guest because you actually have an engineering background as well as being a lawyer. Can you talk a little bit about how you came from being an engineer to deciding to go to law school and become a lawyer?
Okay, I went to MIT, spent 6 years there, and then proceeded to work in the design of biomedical instrumentation that was based on computers. This was the 1970s, and so computers were microprocessors. They were new and exciting, and the magic number then was 8085. And that was also the time when the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was amended to become applicable to devices. And I was intrigued by the idea that the law was going to begin to regulate the kinds of things that I was doing as an engineer. And that was one of the factors that drove me into considering law school. And I was also attracted to the idea that lawyers have a career path where they can, if they choose, basically be consultants for a full career. And I certainly have been borne out for me. I really enjoy. I'm not one who seeks to manage people, and so the fact that I've been able to practice essentially as a consultant for so many years has been.
So, but you're actually not a sort of independent lawyer. You're actually an inside counsel at HP, right?
Exactly right. So I'm an employee, but I get to operate across across the width of the company, which has been a tremendous value to me, especially in coming to understand issues around free software.
Go ahead, Karen.
I was just going to ask when you joined HP.
In 1991.
Oh.
And that's actually how you got involved with free software licensing, right? Because you were sort of this consultant across various aspects that you ended up being the person who ran into GPL first, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, so I would join HP at the end of 91 and very shortly and early in 92, someone from what had been the Apollo computer, which was then a part of HP, one of my client groups, asked me about this unusual document, the GPL, and I began to give advice on it. Other lawyers across the company, although I supported particular business units, and that was where we arranged ourselves, other lawyers came to hear that Peterson had read this odd document, and they sent their questions my direction. And so just by virtue of having sort of been in that, in retrospect, I think, right place, others were kind of discarding their questions in my direction, gave me the opportunity to see a lot more questions and be involved with it to a much greater degree than others might have had the opportunity.
So what made it odd from your point of view when you first looked at it? And we're talking in terms of when you first looked at it, what was odd to it? What was odd about it to you?
Well, it's written in language that is not conventional. I mean, that's really the thing that most lawyers first confront when they read it is that the language, the style in which it is written, the way it describes what its requirements are and so forth, often use phraseology and so forth, which is fairly unconventional. So I think that's what I mean.
So a lot of people talk about the issue of whether the way it uses copyright. Do you find the way it uses copyright novel? Did you at the time? Do you still think of it that way? Sort of how it uses copyright to get the goals of copyleft done.
It took me a while. I'd say quite a few years before I came to an appreciation that I think it uses copyright in a very interesting way. In broad strokes, it's a kind of it's not unusual in the law more generally. It's a license back. You know, the granting of a license sort of conditioned on a license back, which itself is not unusual. It's done particularly in patent law quite routinely. But the idea that it was employing a law designed to exclude. I mean, that's after all, at the end of the day, what copyright law is. It's the right to exclude someone from doing certain things. To employ that to the end of, to almost the opposite end, is a pretty interesting thing to wrap your head around. And I think it's a pretty interesting concept.
Yeah, Scott, actually, maybe now's a good time to ask you about how a company like HP benefits from the way copyleft works, which I think is not obvious to a lot of people on first blush.
Sure. Well, so there's sort of the broad general, and then there's something more specific to copyleft. I mean, there is, in the broad sense, the collaborative development of software that licenses like the GPL facilitate. Is an enormous benefit to commercial enterprises of all sorts. They're commercial enterprises don't, you know, there are things that they may want to focus on that they use that are the points at which they differentiate themselves, and yet there are other areas where, you know, separate independent work is really unproductive. There really ought to be more collaboration. So these licenses facilitate collaboration, and the kind of software development that goes on, I think, plays a very interesting and important role across a range of businesses. But then the GPL, more specifically, and this copyleft feature of it, so there are even reasons why a company might choose to use that license for its own software that it might release in certain circumstances, because in a sense it creates a kind of, from a commercial perspective, I think it was a flat playing field effect. You make the software available knowing that your competitors will have it available to them to use as well, but that if they take it up and use it, you will get the benefit of whatever further transformations of it, enhancements in it they might choose to make. So it creates an interesting, it's an interesting way for a company to release software. In that sense, the restrictions from a commercial perspective have some interesting feature that facilitates the release of software in that way.
Yeah, it's interesting to note. I mean, back when you and I first got involved in this in the early 90s, it was somewhat of a challenge to help people understand that, you know, the not just GPL, but all the free software licenses allowed for commercial improvement and were in fact encouraging commercial stuff. Did you find that challenging in those days to help people understand how it was very pro-commercial, really?
Yes. So there are certainly, for many years, and even now, there may be some sense that there is an anti-commercial element, and there may have been some more misunderstanding about that in years past. I think perhaps it's fading. But there was a time, I think when GPL 3 was completed only a little more than a year ago. But my first experience with GPL 3 in concept was in 1999. A meeting with Richard Stallman and some, to which he had invited a number of representatives of commercial enterprises to talk about how the license might be changed. And so this was my first glimpse into what, how could this thing known as version 2 evolve into version 3? But the nature of that whole conversation was made it absolutely clear to me that this wasn't, commercial versus anti-commercial. It was a different kind of dynamic, very, very different. There's an interest in having a license that fostered a certain kind of, I'm not quite sure, a philosophy relative to software, but that wasn't itself an anti-commercial philosophy. And so for me, that was my kind of illuminating moment to really understand how free software and commercial enterprises aren't inherently at odds with each other.
And then you mentioned that as sort of the beginning of your involvement in the GPLv3 process, but you were eventually on one of the committees, right?
Yes. Committee B, I believe it was.
Yeah.
Yes. I was co-chair of that committee. That was a committee of the four committees. That was the one, I think of it as B for business, sort of. Entirely fair. There were clearly businesses represented in other committees, especially in Committee C. B was more companies that built products that involved free software to a large extent, more so than C, which was more end-user companies. And I must say that was a very interesting year for me.
Yeah, what specifically, I guess we're about a year out now, what specifically about the GPLv3 process hangs in your mind as very interesting things that happened and evolved in the thinking as the committees debated?
Well, it was interesting to watch the diverse range of interests that the Free Software Foundation needed to take into consideration. So this is a license that began in the 1980s, essentially a license employed by a relatively small number of people, small community. And by the time of the GPL3 development activity in 2006, I guess it was, the range of constituencies, shall we say, that employ, for which the GPL3 is important to them, is pretty diverse. And I'm involved in a number of activities relating to standard setting, which involve mm-hmm. collaboration and among diverse interests and so forth. And so I have an appreciation for how difficult it can be to take those diverse interest into consideration. So anyway, just the observation of how that played out was pretty interesting. I was very impressed by how the Free Software Foundation managed that and really did draw on to learn about the inputs from all those interests.
Yeah, so you mentioned standards processes. How would you compare, sort of your experience in doing standards body work with V3? Do you think they're very similar or not very similar? What were the sort of compare and contrast those two experiences?
So there is a lot of similarity in the sense of the the range of interests and the struggle to work to a solution when at the end of the day there are different interests involved, and each might prefer a different outcome. So there is that similarity, but in detail, it was very, very different because in detail, the specific interests are quite different. So there are standard setting is much more typically driven by, at least the standard setting that I see in the computer industry is more typically driven by large commercial enterprises, and the dynamic among them is somewhat different than when you involve as many individual developers or free software projects and the people that manage those, governments. The range of interests is, or the nature in which they engaged is, in some, so at the abstract level it seemed very similar, but the particulars seem fairly different. And the tools that were used, of course, were quite different.
And tools by tools you mean in terms of
both the technical tools as well as the process tools. So mm-hmm. there were these committees, which I thought was an interesting way, as a process matter, to try to take the incredible range of interest and get some I don't know, traction or coherence on working through, as opposed working through how you could sort of, it's sort of like a breaking the problem down from an engineering perspective almost. And then the technical facilities that enabled many more people to be able to make contributions and so forth, and to see the process and see what was going on. Transparency, obviously, a really important thing in that process, because trust is just so critical. That's another feature that is common to standard setting, where trust is a pretty important factor in how people, you know, how things play out.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned, you know, the issue of wanting the transparency and wanting to bring everybody to the table. I mean, I think it was both, you know, SFLC, which ran the process, and FSF's goal as well, to try and make sure everybody who had an interest got to have a say and got to be involved. And as you point out, we really did approach it from this engineering perspective, which, of course, you know, we're, you know, you like we are our primary, our engineers first, and then in the legal world second. I'm curious if you have thoughts about how that interaction has occurred. You know, I often find it challenging to bridge the gap between engineering ideas and legal ideas, because the processes you go through have similarities, but then they differ at certain moments where there's almost a culture clash. I'm sure you must have experienced this, you know, inside HP and talking to people who are engineers and trying to educate them about legal issues. Do you have any thoughts about how that interaction works and what's, you know, what's challenging in it?
Well, it's been, of course, for me, an experience that I only see through the through that sort of perspective of someone who's both an engineer and a lawyer. So it's
which is actually the most unique perspective you can have, I think, because you see it from both sides. Yeah.
Well, for me, the very first and really important realization was when I went to law school. So my greatest fear in going to law school was I'd heard people had to write a lot in law school. This was very concerning to me, because as an engineer, I didn't spend a lot of time writing. I didn't write short stories or letters or things like that particularly. I got to law school, and my fear, I found my fear was entirely unwarranted, because the kind of writing that I did in law school that was required of a law student, and which is the bulk of what I need to do here at HP in terms of providing advice, is a kind of writing which for an engineer, for me, is really easy. Because it's very so there I found an interesting synergy between the kind of analytical perspective of an engineer and what is required of lawyers. It is also why I probably have found myself more comfortable dealing with these free software licenses than some of my colleagues who come from a more conventional liberal arts background and are not engineering oriented, who may feel less comfortable with the technology and be not as familiar with software and how it's built and so forth. And some of the concepts that get kicked around and are kind of important distinctions are harder for them to grasp. And I think that I'm thinking that may be a part of what has contributed to many people's sort of lower level of comfort with free software licenses and the GPL in particular, because it does attempt to say things about how the permissions are given according to how things are technically assembled, which for conventional software licensing is a little daunting to someone that is not as comfortable with the technology. So I've enjoyed sitting in this sort of intermediate place, because it allows me to share in both directions, I guess, right? So I get to share with my engineering colleagues legal concepts, and on the flip side, I get to share with my legal colleagues what I know about the technology. So it's a fun place to sit.
Well, I think actually related to that, I think that a lot of in-house lawyers get a reputation for saying no and for being really difficult for engineers and developers to deal with internally. Have you ever found that, I guess that tension? You're also an engineer, so you're in a unique position, but I wonder, did you also encounter some resistance with the engineering side to to integrate your legal advice with their work?
So this idea of saying no is absolutely something that I have observed, and I think it might be in part when not well understood, no is the safe answer, and so that's an oversimplification. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a component of that. I think good lawyers struggle to find ways to help their clients be successful, mm-hmm. and that requires a more sophisticated response than no. I mean, it may be that the course that some activity is on really is ill-conceived and needs adjustment, but there are more constructive ways to proceed oftentimes than no. And perhaps this is one of the things that I really benefit, again, by being an in-house lawyer at a company like HP. I involved, I think, probably much more in a team-like world than outside lawyers to whom tasks and questions and so forth are given. I have ongoing interaction with the businesses and the technologists, and we work, it's much more of a work together to figure out, for me to understand what they're trying to do and for them to understand from me what the constraints are that they need to deal with. So I think that's partly an advantage of being in-house. It's one of the things that attracted me. So I worked as an outside lawyer for several years before becoming an in-house lawyer, and I have absolutely enjoyed the close collaboration with the technologists and the business people.
Yeah, I mean, that's you're almost like you're describing a free software community style of operating as an inside counsel, which I think that sounds just great. It sounds like it's an excellent way for engineers to actually listen to their lawyers and listen to the advice they have instead of the just say no scenario that Karen was describing. So I do want to get a little bit one last question about that's a little more on the legal opinion side, and if you can't comment fully, we certainly understand. But obviously we've watched very closely the decision in the Bilski case regarding software patents or so-called software patents. We're curious to hear any thoughts you are allowed to share with us about that particular decision.
So I guess so. My reaction is I found it astonishingly unremarkable. So I anticipated, of course, that given the topic that the Federal Circuit is talking about in this opinion, that it would get a lot of press, and it certainly has, and people interpret it many ways. But so think back. So I was saying I worked as an engineer in the 70s. So that meant that I went to law school in the early 80s, and through the 80s and into the mid to late 90s, I'm a patent attorney, so I wrote patent applications. I haven't written any patent applications in, I think, 10 years now. But during the time that I was involved in writing patent applications in the computer industry, I was obviously very cognizant of what the law was around how you could claim various kinds of computer-related inventions. And to my eye, the recent Bilski decision is describing rules that essentially were what I had assumed were always the case. And so it may be that those who have focused on the details of what's happening with claiming these kinds of inventions in more recent years have come to imagine more abstract things could be claimed. If one looks at the claim at issue, one of the sample claims that's at issue in the Bilski case, it's cast in very abstract terms. To my eye, from the 80s, it would not surprise me that would not pass muster. On the other hand, that the decision doesn't loom to me as being of enormous significance in saying that we're not going to have business method patents or we're not going to have software patents. It sort of reverts one to the tests and mentality of that earlier time where there's a particular perspective on thinking about inventions as machines and processes and so forth. So I think that it probably will stand for perhaps stopping the trend toward increasingly abstract business methods. But I think even the famous State Street, the patent that issued State Street, probably stands muster under the new Bilski rule. So even it's anyway. So I think it reflects the fact that some judges are realizing there ought to be some limits here, but it doesn't, to my view, reflect any dramatic change.
Yeah, I mean, we had a somewhat similar feeling here that it's, yeah. I mean, of course, you know, you don't necessarily share our positions, I should be clear, but as you know, the SFLC would like to see an end to software patents because they're bad for free software. But we didn't feel that this was...
Right, the answer isn't in Bilski, unfortunately.
Yeah, and we agree with that, certainly. We see it as a step in the right direction, but just one step, not actually taking the giant leap we'd like to see from our advocacy position. So, Scott, I really want to thank you for making the time to do this interview with us. It was just so wonderful for us to speak with you, and I'm just absolutely honored that you were willing to be our first guest on our podcast. We're so thankful for your time.
Well, I really appreciate the invitation. It's been wonderful, and of course I enjoy working with the both of you. And so for me, this was an easy interview to have. I appreciate the offer. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Scott.
I'm so glad we were able to have Scott on for our first guest. It was really interesting to hear his views on the variety of different things we talked to him about, in particular his views on the Bilski case that we asked him about.
Yeah, which we actually read together.
Yeah, it was certainly interesting to do that.
It was really fun for me. I haven't really actually actively read a case together with someone since law school.
And I haven't been to law school, so I've never read a case with anybody. You know, I just usually read them online when they're linked to from some article related to free software.
And in this case, we were reading and we were both sort of getting a little frustrated at what the case didn't do. And
yeah, I mean, obviously, as an anti-software patents person, like most people in the free software industry in particular and the software industry in general, most people are not for software patents. We were hoping to find something that said software patents were dead, mm-hmm. and in fact, there were footnotes that said specifically that's not what they were doing.
Right. And but I think that what Scott was saying was that it did something very important, which is that it brought forward that old precedent, and that's also what Dan Ravisher said when we consulted him, mm-hmm. and he's our patent attorney here. He's our legal director, and he also teaches patent law at Cardozo Law School.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was pretty interesting. Oh, one thing I did want to clarify, though, because I guess in reading all of the discussions about Bilski, much is being made about the overturning of State Street.
Yeah, a lot of the headlines say that.
Yeah, and even actually in our statement, too, we put in that part of that some of State Street was overturned. And I guess I just wanted to clarify that...
The patent's not overturned.
That what we meant was that the patent is not overturned, but that a test that was established in mm-hmm. State Street is no longer relevant as the test to use when, you know, it in this way.
Yeah. It's. I mean, as we said in our statement, it's one step forward towards the abolition of software patents, mm-hmm. but it's just one step in a long march to getting there. I was most excited to see that the very pro-patent judges seemed to be saying that they thought it was the worst thing ever, which to me says it must be at least a little bit good, because if very extremely pro software patent judges are in their dissents are saying this is the most horrible thing ever, then it must be something good about it. So I think it's a good step forward. It's like most I think it's a frustrating thing about the way legal precedents work is it takes such time to change the way things operate, and that's
yeah. And I think in this instance it was peculiar because I think that there was a lot of vagueness introduced while at the same time a lot of vagueness was eliminated because all of those other tests were eliminated and they stuck to the machine or transformation test.
Yeah, that's
anyway, it was great to get Scott's view on it. It's definitely a unique opportunity.
Well, that wraps up episode one of the Software Freedom Law Show. We thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States License.